This Janet Meffer Today podcast is brought to you by Same Kind of Different as Me, based on an unforgettable true story of forgiveness, friendship, family, and faith. Same Kind of Different as Me in theaters now. More information at samekindofdifferentasmemovie.com.
This is Janet Meffer Today.
Our confidence is in Christ alone.
Are we going to stand with God, come what may?
If the Word of God says it, I believe it.
And that's the way it is.
And now, here is Janet Meffer.
Thanks so much for joining us again. If you're a Christian who has been diagnosed with a mental illness, is something wrong with you spiritually? Have you failed to pray enough, or has your faith in Christ been too weak to help you overcome your struggle? Sounds terrible, but those are some of the rather harsh questions that are sometimes asked of Christians who genuinely might be struggling with mental illnesses, making them feel as if even a clinical diagnosis of a chemical imbalance in the brain, for example, is somehow a spiritual failure. The bottom line is that it's important for us as Christians to understand what mental illness really is and how we are to understand it, both clinically and biblically. So we're going to discuss this today with Dr. Matthew Stanford. He is CEO of the Hope and Healing Center and Institute in Houston and is adjunct professor in the Menninger Department of Psychiatry and Behavioral Sciences at Baylor College of Medicine and the Department of Psychology at the University of Houston. And today we'll be talking about the new edition of his book. It is called Grace for the Afflicted, a Clinical and Biblical Perspective on Mental Illness. Matt, it's great to welcome you here. How are you?
I'm good. Thank you for having me.
Thank you so much for being here. All right, let's talk a little bit, maybe first, about what a mental illness is, clinically speaking, because I think definitions will help when we're trying to wade through this issue.
Yeah, a mental illness is a disorder in which an individual's thoughts, their feelings, their emotions, their ability to relate to others are impaired in such a way and at such an intensity that they're not able to function normally unless somebody intervenes with some type of a treatment.
Yes. So this would be something that seems on its surface to be a medical issue that Christians shouldn't have a problem with. Why do you think there are some Christians who have questioned whether or not there's a spiritual component that is driving somebody to behave or have moods of a certain type that really are based in a mental illness? Why the disconnect there?
Yeah, I think there's a couple of different reasons why. I think one is that just generally people kind of question mental health problems because we all have kind of feelings and thoughts and impressions, and sometimes we get sad and sometimes we get anxious. And so we believe that our own personal experiences in relationship to those are exactly the same as everyone else. So if someone tells you they're depressed, you think, oh, well, I was sad. I worked my way through that. I know what that's like. You don't really appreciate that what they have is a disorder of their brain that they have no control over. And I think I think that's one reason. I think we think that our experience with these things is the same as other people's. And so we think, well, you just kind of need to get over that.
Yeah.
I think secondly, from a spiritual perspective, you know, the Bible talks about, you know, worrying, and it talks about sadness and happiness, and it talks about a lot of different kind of emotional issues and things like that, and so in feelings and how we relate to one another. And I think we kind of almost as believers, we put those things almost immediately into a spiritual context. And again, we believe that those normal states that the Bible is talking about, like, so for instance, when Paul talks about, about not worrying, but trusting in God, we equate that with someone who has an anxiety disorder, and
yeah,
we don't really appreciate that person has a disorder of their brain that in which their body is in an all-out ongoing stress response, and they have no control over it. And that's a very different thing than what Paul is talking about.
It's so true. Something came into my mind when you were talking about that. I had a period of time after my fourth baby where I had kind of extra anxiety, kind of a postpartum thing, and it was a hormonal thing. And every time I would go to those verses about have no anxiety about anything, but in everything by prayer and supplication with thanksgiving, let your requests be made known to God, and the peace of God, Christ that passes all understanding, will keep your hearts and minds in Christ Jesus. And I kept reciting that over and over, and it didn't help. What helped was when the hormonal problem was fixed. And that's
right.
That was frustrating because as a Christian, I was saying, why do I have so much anxiety? Well, it's not always your fault.
No, it's not always your fault. And then those verses can come off very condemning to you.
Yeah.
Because you're saying, look, I'm trying. I'm doing this. I'm trying to not be anxious. And the reality is, anxiety is a normal state that God has made. It rouses us to action. It keeps us out of danger. but the system that causes anxiety in our brain, that picks up threats in the environment and things like that, it can be out of whack,
yeah.
And it can run amok, and then, you know, that's a whole different, it's just like when your pancreas runs amok and isn't able to control your blood sugar, nobody ever says, well, I'm going to recite some Bible verses to you and your pancreas is going to be okay.
No, and those sorts of people can end up in jail if something goes wrong,
right.
Yeah, for sure. So when you're looking at the body as a whole, I thought this was very interesting when you were talking about the fact that we live in a sinful world and sin has infected every part of us. How does that fit together in a discussion about mental illness and how we ought to see it biblically?
Yeah, I think, you know, one of the problems that we get into as believers is I think we very quickly forget how God created us, and he has created us as a multi-part being, as a body, mind, spirit, and then also relationships. I looked at Luke 2:52. It says Jesus grew in wisdom and stature and in favor with God and man, and I kind of see the four aspects of our being. And when we fell as a race, you know, we fell at all levels. Our spirit was affected, our mind is affected, our body was affected, and so were our relationships. And I think few Christians would argue with that. And we live in a fallen world where there is disease and suffering and horrible hurricanes and things like that. And I think what we do, unfortunately, when we look at somebody, in fact, I think we do it from both perspectives. When we look at somebody, say, who has cancer, we're very compassionate to them in the church, and we want to, you know, want to help their family, want to pray for them. But I think we a lot of times forget that that affects a person in more than just a physical way. It affects them spiritually, it affects them mentally, it affects their relationships. So we almost think of that as almost a solely physical issue. But really, every distress, every disorder affects us at all levels. And with mental illness, we do it just the opposite. We tend to not recognize that as a physical illness, and we over-spiritualize it, and we say, well, this is a spiritual-only issue. And we forget that sin has caused us to be broken at every level, and that cancer happens because of sin, you know, original sin, brokenness in the world, and mental illness happens because of sin, brokenness in the world, original sin, and it affects us at all levels. And when we intervene, or when we try to comfort or care for somebody, we need to intervene at all levels. And I think the thing that the church has to remember is, as a body, we have the opportunity to intervene at all levels. We're not just spiritual kind of monks out there. We can help people at a physical level. Jesus did. We can help people at a relational level. We can help people at a mental level. And we need to think about that. God made us physical and non-physical. Unfortunately, we're broken. But thank God for Christ,
yes.
And the opportunity to know God and an opportunity to be redeemed.
Yeah, that's right. Is there one mental illness that is more common than the others?
Yes, depression and anxiety issues are by far the most common, and so you will see those more often in the populace. I think that if you look at depression, for instance, it's a little bit more common in women than it is in men, whereas anxiety disorders tend to be equally common in men and women. But those are, without a doubt, the most common of the mental health problems.
That's interesting. Now, when you talk about an anxiety disorder, would you separate disorders from true mental illnesses? Because you think of something like schizophrenia, where something, you know, it's somebody can really act strangely with that. But if somebody is anxious, people might say that's a different kind of thing. Is there a distinction, would you say, between a disorder and a serious mental illness?
No, anxiety disorders are considered serious mental illnesses. I mean, again, we have a tendency, and we do it, I mean, even I do it, we all do it in this society. We use psychological terms very cheaply, and people will say, oh, I'm so depressed today, or, you know, I'm so OCD because you're neat. In reality, those are very serious, debilitating illnesses. So someone who has generalized anxiety disorder can be so non-functional that they can't even leave their home because their anxiety is so overwhelming. Now, obviously, when you're looking at, say, something like schizophrenia, which is one of the psychotic disorders in the schizophrenia spectrum, the person loses contact with reality. They become delusional. They may hallucinate. I mean, they believe things that aren't true. They act out those things. They may think someone's out to get them or harm them. They may hear voices. And those people will tend to act extremely odd. And so almost anyone can pick up that person is struggling, having a problem. Whereas someone with generalized anxiety disorder will tend to isolate themselves and people won't see that they're ill.
Very interesting. There's a lot more to talk about. We'll do it when we come back with Dr. Matthew Stanford, Grace for the Afflicted, a clinical and biblical perspective on mental illness. We'll be right back on Janet Mefford Today.
Here is today's Capitol Hill Brief with Concerned Women for America President Penny Nance.
When you read your speeches, the conclusion one draws is that the dogma lives loudly within you, and that's of concern.
Now, with Senator Dianne Feinstein of California proudly imposing an unconstitutional religious test on the Seventh Circuit Court of Appeals nominee Amy Barrett. And she was not the only one to focus on the nominee's faith. Senators Dick Durbin of Illinois and Al Franken of Minnesota also joined in the shameful display of anti-Christian rhetoric. Friends, this type of mistrust and outright hostility towards people of faith is a threat to freedom and liberty. We must stand against it.
Devout Catholics shouldn't be judges because of their strong faith. At least that's what Senator Dianne Feinstein thinks. Fight for religious freedom with your voice of influence, Concerned Women for America. Visit CapitolHillBrief.org. That's CapitolHillBrief.org. If credit card debt has you down, nonprofit Trinity Debt Management can help. Trinity will consolidate your accounts into one easy-to-manage monthly payment, put a stop to late fees, and drastically reduce your interest. You'll pay thousands less than you originally owed. It's not a loan. It's a way to become debt-free and possibly improve your credit score. So call Trinity and talk to a certified counselor. They'll explain their proven program to you with no pressure, just practical solutions and hope for tomorrow. Are you ready to pay off your credit cards in less time for less money? Then call for a free, no-obligation debt analysis and become debt-free for keeps.
When I called Trinity, the lady that helped me was very understanding. They did help me learn how to manage my money. Now, you know, we have a house and we're doing a lot better.
If your debt has you down, call Trinity at 1-800-793-8752. That number again, 1-800-793-8752. Welcome back to Janet Mefford Today. Dr. Matthew Stanford is with us, CEO of the Hope and Healing Center and Institute in Houston and author of Grace for the Afflicted, a clinical and biblical perspective on mental illness, which I think is such an important topic to discuss. One of the things, Matt, that I think has become an issue in the church regarding how we view mental illness is there are a lot of Christians who do have problems with psychiatry, psychotherapy, these sorts of things. They have a theological problem with the practices themselves and some of the purveyors of these methods and so forth. How do you see that in the context, you know, being a Christian and trying to deal with all these issues? How would you answer some of those concerns, especially when somebody says, you know, this person has a serious mental illness and needs to get some therapy to deal with it by somebody who understands this disorder really well, and then might hear a Christian friend say, you can't go to a psychotherapist because that would be unbiblical. What do you say to that?
No, and that's unfortunately more and more common in the church today. I mean, first off, I would say that, you know, I think we should always be cautious whether we're a believer or not believer when we're going to get treatment for a serious illness, regardless of whether that's a mental illness or not. I think, you know, just from my personal experience of working with Christians that have had those concerns, almost all the arguments that people have against psychotherapy or taking psychiatric medication are really kind of a misunderstanding of biblical principles. I mean, you know, that certainly there have been people in psychology, and probably one of the more famous would be Sigmund Freud, who believed that religion itself was an illness and that he had no place for illness and for religion, excuse me, because he was an atheist. But I mean, you know, to kind of throw the baby out with the bathwater, all psychology, all psychiatry is bad because here are a few prominent people within the discipline that believed, you know, that religion was a bad thing. You know, I mean, I go to a doctor, and the American Medical Association says that abortions are a perfectly appropriate elective procedure, I mean, should I not go to a doctor who's been okayed by the American Medical Association and medical resuscitation and received a license? I mean, we treat mental illnesses totally different than we treat other illnesses. I've heard people say, much like we just said, well, don't, if you're going to go to a psychologist or you're going to go to a psychiatrist, make sure you go to a Christian. Mm-hmm. But, you know, when they're being rushed to the hospital, you know, after the car accident, they're not telling the EMT, well, only take me to a hospital where the ER doctor's a Christian.
Yeah.
You know, or an oncologist is a, you know, and I've kind of flippantly said, you know, I mean, I might personally be concerned about it, but if I had cancer, I want the best cancer doctor in the world. I don't care if he worships a tree. I might personally care.
Right.
But I want him to be a really good doctor at that moment. And so I think we, again, have tended to treat them differently. Now, again, we get back to this idea of feelings and emotions. And I think Christians are concerned that somehow they're going to be altered by a psychologist to somehow be against the faith or do something that they shouldn't do. But again, I think you could have that concern about almost anyone that treats you. And you always should be on guard from the world, and you should always be founded in the church, and that's where your spiritual guidance comes from.
Yeah, and the truth is, I mean, if we're just being honest about this, you can go to a bad Christian counselor too. It's true.
Absolutely. I mean, no, there's no doubt about it. I would say another way I've said it is, just because you put Christian in front of counselor doesn't mean you know what you're doing.
Exactly.
I mean, you can be a really bad a bad counselor.
Yes.
And you know, you have to be real careful with that. And unfortunately, I've seen a lot of people say, "Well, this guy, he's a Christian. Well, that means everything's going to be great." Well, I mean, that doesn't necessarily mean that. And then we get into all kind of nuances of it. Some people will only go to certain kinds of Christians that are, you know, or that practice only this, you know, maybe biblical counseling versus this. So, I mean, it really starts to get broken down. But again, if we step back, we're treating, in many instances, what are very serious brain disorders, an organ in your body that, as I've said, because I taught neuroanatomy for 20 years at the, you know, to graduate students, is just 3 pounds of meat in your head. I mean, it's just an organ like your liver, and it can be damaged, and we treat it completely different in the church than we treat any other organ.
Wow. Talk a little bit, because I'm fascinated by this. Talk about, if you would, what are the clinical reasons for some of these illnesses? When you're approaching it, medically speaking, for example, if you're suffering from schizophrenia or if you're suffering from depression, what is wrong with your body that is causing that?
Okay. Well, in a broader sense, I like to use kind of what's called a diathesis stress model, which basically, you know, everybody always asks this question: is this biological or is this environmental or nurture? And the answer is it's both. Every mental health problem, every mental illness is a combination of biology and environment. So we are all born with some biological vulnerabilities. We have vulnerabilities to certain types of illnesses. We have vulnerabilities to cancer. We have vulnerabilities to mental illness. And those can be passed down to us through our families. You know, we know suicide runs in families, as does addiction and things like that. So you have this biological vulnerability. You also have certain traumas that occur to you in utero. Your mother may have drank alcohol, or she may have been in an accident, or she didn't take prenatal vitamins. And then when you're born, you also live in, and then you begin to live in an environment that's affecting you. So you might be traumatized. You might have horrible parents that abuse you, or you might be neglected. And so as you're born with a vulnerability, that's the diathesis, and a fancy word for it, and you also then begin to interact with the environment, which does things to you. So sometimes you're traumatized and things like that happen, or just stressors occur in your life. Maybe you live in poverty, maybe your family doesn't have a lot of money, or you live in a violent neighborhood or whatever. And then your biology is interacting with your environment. So if you're an overly sensitive person, perhaps you react to the environment differently than if you're not a very overly sensitive person. And then as time goes on, the combination of stress and biology kind of brings to the forefront a mental health problem. And so depending on how much stress, so let's say you have a very high load of biological vulnerability. Say your mother was schizophrenic. People who have a mentally ill parent are 5 times more likely than the general population to have a mental illness as an adult. Part of that's biology, and part of that is that you were raised by a mentally ill parent. So you have this biological vulnerability to schizophrenia, and then you have a very high load. You don't need a lot of stress to have that come out. But let's say you have very little vulnerability, but you're born and then you are neglected, like physically neglected and abused. That's a lot of stress with a low vulnerability that could draw out a mental health problem. So it's a combination of the two. Things like schizophrenia and bipolar disorder have a much higher biological load. It's not to say the others don't, but they're mostly biological. And so it's just a combination. What's going on in the brain is either a miswiring of the circuitry in the brain in some disorders, or differences in the way the neurons are able to communicate with one another. Sometimes there's too much of a neurochemical, sometimes there's too little of a neurochemical. But again, these are biological-based disorders, and it's the person can't just kind of think their way out of it. It requires a combination of usually medication and therapy. And when a person gets medication and therapy together, and they engage their treatment, usually they can live a very normal life.
Right. Now, how would you distinguish, for example, you gave the example a while back about somebody who might be just sad or having a depressive episode because of somebody died or something like that, versus somebody who suffers from clinical depression. How do you tell the difference?
Yeah, that's a great question, because that's really where the kind of rubber meets the road and where you see all the mistakes. And just to kind of give you an example of how the mistake might happen before I tell you how, is a pastor might say, well, so maybe you come in and you have clinical depression. And he says, oh, well, I've worked with several women who have depression, and we go through this Bible study, and they've all done fantastic. Hmm. Well, the problem is I don't know that all those women had depression. Right. They may have just been profoundly sad. So in clinical depression, for instance, the depth of the sadness is overwhelming. The person is in a darkness that is overwhelming. They feel hopeless, worthless. They can't remember times of joy in their life. They're unable to move beyond that, and it causes them literally to not be able to function effectively. They can't go to work and work effectively, or they can't go to school. Their relationships begin to break down because they begin to isolate themselves. So the depth and the intensity of the sadness and the depression is literally overwhelming.
Yeah.
Whereas in a kind of a blues or profound sadness, maybe even from a reactive depression from the death of a loved one or something like that, the individual may be overwhelmed by sadness, but they can remember when they were happy before. They'll have periods of time where they can experience happiness or joy. So, for instance, maybe they're very, very sad, but their friends drag them out to a movie. Okay, mm-hmm. And then after the fact, they go, hey, thanks for doing that. That helped me. But then an hour later, they're back to their sadness. With depression, it wouldn't matter what you did. The person simply cannot experience happiness. They are numb to that experience. It's really a difference in the intensity and the depth. It's also a difference in the how long it lasts. Blue periods can last maybe weeks. Depression never goes away.
Right.
It just hangs on. And so, it really isn't that difficult to train a pastor. Just in a few minutes, you can sit down and explain to them the difference, and they can begin to differentiate that difference. It's the same thing between worry and an anxiety issue. Worrying can be a real problem. An anxiety issue causes you not to be able to be functional.
Yeah. So basically, what we really need to be aware of as Christians is that there are people in our midst who are suffering this way who are Christians too. And we need to be sensitive to that, not be judgmental and immediately say, oh, you're just not praying enough. You're not having enough faith, because we don't necessarily know. Take the time to find out, perhaps.
No, absolutely. And I think, unfortunately, what we do, because many people in the church have taken those positions, a lot of Christians that are struggling with these issues just keep quiet, and then they suffer in silence. And we just need to show more grace, and we need to understand that these are a real thing. This is not some conspiracy of the world somehow affirms sin, as one pastor told me. I wasn't exactly sure how that was going to, but he also thought that depression was a sin. He thought anxiety was a sin. And we have to understand that, one out of every five Americans is struggling with a mental health problem in a given year. 450 million people in the world. This isn't just a U.S. thing.
No, it isn't. Grace for the afflicted. Dr. Matthew Stanford, thank you so much, Matt, for being with us.
Great. Thank you for having me.
God bless you. We'll be back. This Janet Mefford Today podcast is brought to you by Same Kind of Different as Me, based on an unforgettable true story of forgiveness, friendship, family, and faith. Same Kind of Different as Me in theaters now. More information at samekindofdifferentasmemovie.com. This Janet Mefford Today podcast is brought to you by Same Kind of Different as Me, based on an unforgettable true story of forgiveness, friendship, family, and faith. Same Kind of Different as Me in theaters now. More information at samekindofdifferentasmemovie.com. We are back on Janet Mefford Today. The Bible says it is required of stewards that one be found trustworthy. Stewardship is not optional for the Christian, but mandatory. And that's because everything that God has entrusted to us ultimately belongs to Him. But what do you do when your financial situation has become too much for you? And maybe you have debt you can't pay off, or you need some solid advice on buying or renting a home. These are some very common issues that come up. And we're going to talk about them now with Jay Durham, who is Director of Operations for one of our new partners, Trinity Debt Management, a nonprofit agency that provides counseling and debt management services for people who are experiencing problems like these. And Jade, it's great to welcome you here. How are you?
All right, good. Thanks for having me today, Janet. I appreciate it.
Thank you for being with us. Why do you think debt is such a big issue today, even for Christians? Because for many Christians, they say, oh, we shouldn't be in debt, and yet we have problems with it from time to time.
Right, right. And so much of what we see, it's certainly not frivolous spending, but unexpected changes in life, whether it's, being laid off from your job or unforeseen medical expenses. So even if you have the mindset of we're not going to accumulate debt, sometimes it is unavoidable and then can become very overwhelming when you're not prepared with dealing with it or knowing the best way to deal with it.
Right. That's exactly it. What kinds of situations do you tend to see as a nonprofit as far as people having problems with their credit or financial problems?
Mm-hmm. A lot of the clients that we deal with specifically have credit card debt. And again, a lot of this has accumulated because during times of reduced income or unemployment, they have had to charge their living expenses on credit cards. Some people even pay for medical bills on credit cards to prevent them from going to collections. But once they have the debt, they're unprepared to make that minimum payment, especially when they have significant interest rates. So much of the payment is going towards interest, and then it becomes even more frustrating. I got this debt when I didn't want to, and now I'm not seeing my balance going down because most of my payment is going towards finance charges, and right. It's very defeating when you're making that payment and struggling to do so and not seeing that you're making a significant difference in bringing that debt load down at all.
Right. So what would you say are some of the misconceptions that people tend to have about debt or getting out of debt?
Mm-hmm. So many people think, this is a quick fix. We plan on being able to pay this off quickly. But then when the bill comes in and it says, well, the minimum required payment is only X, so many individuals just fall back on only paying that minimum.
Right.
And that's where you see it's an endless cycle where you could be paying for a credit card for 15 or 20 years, but you haven't really planned your budget to be able to allocate more, and it is very frustrating.
Yeah. So what sorts of services do you offer as far as credit help? How does it work when people come to you as a nonprofit, Trinity Debt Management? What sorts of help can they find to solve the problem that they have? Maybe they've accumulated, as you said, unforeseen credit card debt because of medical bills or some kind of crisis situation in their lives.
Right. So the first step is identifying, what was the reason for accumulating this debt. Identifying the root cause, because some of it may be a bad behavior of overspending. So we want to identify that and be able to change that behavior or put together a plan that is going to work for that particular individual moving forward. And really looking at their finances, making recommendations on where we could eliminate or reduce some of those outgoing expenses in their budget, and then focusing on the debt. Specifically for credit cards, we are able, through a debt management program, to assist clients with stopping late fees, lowering the interest rates that they're charged, and setting up a more affordable monthly payment. So through a debt management program, it does allow us to kind of restructure things into more favorable terms for the client, but they're still paying the debt back in full. So the key is staying current, paying back the full balances, but getting that affordable payment at the lower interest rate so you can see an end in sight and knowing that the balances are going down each month.
Sure. Now, one of the issues that I know is so important to you guys is the concept of stewardship, which I mentioned right at the outset, and people as managers of the finances that God ultimately owns. How does that approach inform what you do?
Right. So many people come to us, and that is the first thing that they want to know is, you know, are we a Christian-based company? You know, when we're reviewing their financial situation, we know how important it is for them to, you know, make a tithe or make an offering to their church or whomever they see fit. And that's definitely something we want to keep in the budget. So in restructuring things or finding ways to reduce or eliminate expenses, that would never be something that we would ever recommend, you know, knowing the importance of doing that. And, you know, still having that commitment, being able to still see through and pay down the debt. So we hold that in such a high regard and know that that is a critical component to most people's budgets.
Right. Well, and another thing that I'm sure comes up quite a bit is money management. So there are many people who just don't know how to budget. They don't know how to handle their finances. What are some ideas that you would offer for managing your money in an appropriate, God-honoring way?
Mm-hmm. And so many people too, Janet, it's very person specific. You know, there's no one size fits all way for budgeting for individuals. And so again, that comes down to kind of the root cause of what got you into the debt. You know, what are your habits? For a lot of people, it could be just going to a cash only system and knowing we only have X amount to allocate to these different categories in our budget. For some people, you know, it's keeping your receipts and then looking at week to week, okay, how much have I spent? How much more do I have for the rest of the month? There's a lot of great online tools, but it's, like I said, it's different for everyone. Not all individuals want to budget the same way, and it's especially challenging when it's a couple and both of them don't do things the same way. So
right,
we really want to customize and work with people and identify, okay, what's going to really work best for you? Because the more complicated it is, the less likely that you're going to see it through and actually create a working budget.
For sure. Now, what about things like student loans? This is another area that you address, and many, many families are just feeling like they're drowning with student loan debt. You know, you have kids coming out of college, students coming out of college with huge amounts of debt. How can Trinity help with those sorts of issues?
Mm-hmm. Certainly, looking at their student loans, unfortunately, it's very easy to acquire the loans, but they don't give you a lot of information on the best way to repay them. Once you're required to start a repayment plan, you know, the Department of Education or whomever the servicer is, it says, here is your monthly payment. And for most people, they're not making enough money to be able to afford that payment yet. And students or parents, you know, don't realize that there are actually a lot of available programs to assist in setting up more affordable terms for people with student loans. So we want to explore those options and see what kind of restructuring of their loans is going to be best suited for them, because like I said, there's a lot of options. They're just not made aware of it.
Sure.
You know, they can easily be provided a loan, but then they're kind of left to figure it out on their own. So we can, you know, tailor something that, again, is going to fit in their budget and makes the most sense moving forward.
Yeah, very good. Well, as a nonprofit, how does the program work? How would somebody get started if they were interested in getting some assistance from Trinity?
Right. So the first step is just a free analysis. So the nice thing about Trinity is we do offer our services nationwide. So anyone can call in, speak with a certified counselor, and you want to be prepared to have your bills or your statements together so that we can go through that free assessment and take a closer look at your finances as well as your debts. And then from there, determine, is a debt management program going to be the best option or what further recommendations we can make? So it's really a phone call in or even going onto our website, trinitycredit.org. You can begin the free analysis with our online portal.
Very good. Now, when somebody calls in and they decide they want to move forward, then you have to apply. Is that how it works from there?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, once they go through the analysis and review the accounts, from there to enroll into a debt management program, there is paperwork that has to be signed authorizing us to put the arrangements in place. But another convenient aspect of a debt management program is clients just make one monthly payment to Trinity. So instead of having multiple individual bills to pay every month for their debt, they're just paying a payment to Trinity. We're managing that, dispersing it to all of their creditors or lenders at those reduced terms that we've set up. So that just relieves another stress and another headache for our clients, knowing that Trinity's got it taken care of. We're making sure payments are being made on time every month at those lower arrangements. Many clients save thousands of dollars in interest as they see that their accounts are being paid down.
Very good. Well, 800-793-8752 is the toll-free number to call, 800-793-8752 or trinitycredit.org. Jade Durham with us from Trinity Debt Management. Thank you so much, Jade, for being here.
Thank you.
We'll be right back on Janet Mefford Today. Are you among the millions of Americans who feel uncertain when it comes to their health care? As a Christian, are you looking for health care that doesn't violate your morals and convictions? We are happy to inform you that there is a solution, and that solution is Liberty HealthShare. Liberty HealthShare is a community of like-minded Christians who work together to pay for their medical costs. It allows you to decide how, when, and where you will access health care, so you can make the best choice for you and your family. Starting at $107 a month for a single, up to $449 a month for a family. That's mom, dad, and all the kids. This is how healthcare should be. For more information, call 855-585-4237 or visit libertyhealthshare.org. That's libertyhealthshare.org, and regain control over your healthcare costs. That number again, 855-585-4237 or libertyhealthshare.org. Together, we're changing healthcare for good.
From Paramount Pictures and PureFlix comes Same Kind of Different as Me. Ron and Debbie Hall have everything they could ever want, except for a loving marriage. But when Debbie befriends a homeless man, their lives begin to intersect, and they are all changed forever.
Amazing how far a little 10 or 11 care can go.
Same Kind of Different as Me, based on the true story, now playing, rated PG-13. May be inappropriate for children under 13. More information is available at samekindofdifferentasmemovie.com.
2 million refugees are in Lebanon today, living in disease-ridden tent settlements. Most of them are children. But through Heart for Lebanon's Hope Centers, these children are getting a Christian education and meals and hearing about Jesus for the first time. When you call 866-485-9187 with a gift of $22, you'll help rescue four of these children. And right now, your gift will be matched by a ministry friend. These little ones need your assistance. Please call now. 866-485-9187. 866-485-9187 or JanetMefford.com. We are back on Janet Mefford Today. Well, I don't know if it's just sheer mockery or if it's just the firestorm that the UK government is receiving from this news, but this is an interesting story. It involves the UK, as has been reported, their foreign office recommending to the UN that as it changes its International Covenant on Civil and Political Rights about the death penalty, they should change the wording of shall not be carried out on pregnant women. And as it was reported over the weekend, it should not be pregnant women. It should be changed to say that the death penalty shall not be carried out on pregnant people. Now, you and I know that is crazy talk, because there's only one sort of person who actually can be pregnant, and that would be a female. This is something everybody knows and everybody understands and everybody knows why. But in this day and age of transgender mania, we're all supposed to pretend that if a woman suddenly decides to become a man and call herself transgender, that magically she's transformed herself into something other than a woman. No, she hasn't. She's still a woman. Remember the pregnant man that got all this press coverage a few years back? And everybody said, it's a woman. It's not a man. It's not like all of a sudden there's been some great biological change that's come upon the population. It's a man. But pregnant people. Now it's kind of interesting because The Guardian is saying the UK government has kind of come back from this and said, well, we didn't really say that. I mean, there have been campaigners and the British Medical Association who want the expression pregnant people to replace pregnant women so it doesn't exclude trans or intersex men. Yeah, because there's so many intersex men getting pregnant. There's so many intersex men, period. There aren't very many intersex people, period. So they're kind of walking that back. But it's kind of funny. The Foreign Office spokeswoman said it had not asked for the contentious words women or woman to be expunged from this treaty. But here's what she said. The UK does not object to the use of the term pregnant woman. We strongly support the right to life of pregnant women, and we have requested that the Human Rights Committee does not exclude pregnant transgender people from that right to life. Okay, well, then you've basically just said what everybody is reporting that you said. We have no problem with pregnant women, but we just want pregnant people to be included too. It's just insanity. Over at Sky News in the UK, this columnist from the Daily Mirror, a woman by the name of Susie Boniface, had this to say. This is more craziness. Listen to cut one.
This is some advice from the Foreign Office, which was a response to a draft UN human rights paper. It mentioned mums in this document, and some particularly over-enthusiastic bureaucratic Waller has said, oh, we shouldn't say mums, we should say pregnant people rather than mums. Now, that's a little bit over-enthusiastic, like I said, but I've been a pregnant person, I would be fine being called a person rather than a mum. And bear in mind, you're not a mum quite often until you actually have had given birth. So when you're pregnant, you're pregnant, you're a pregnant person, not a mum. It's difficult.
Yeah, it's difficult. First of all, no, I wasn't a pregnant person. I was a pregnant mom, as we say in the United States, because you're a mom the minute that you conceive. You have a baby within you and you're the baby's mom. And the reason pregnant people or pregnant person is bad is because it is going along with a lying agenda that somehow you have to give a gender neutral attribution to people who can become pregnant when we all know, in fact, that only one sex can become pregnant and there's nothing that the transgender community can do about that. So we move on to Camille Paglia. I've got to pull some of her quotes, and I know she speaks in really an awkward way. She says, okay, way too much. And I recognize it's a little annoying, but she's a feminist. She's a cultural commentator, and she is not on board with the transgender nut stuff, mania, whatever you want to call it. She thinks that early medical intervention in children who are confused about their gender is child abuse. She had this to say back in 2016. Listen to cut two.
I personally believe that anyone who collaborates in an intrusion into a developing child's body and mind is guilty of child abuse, a crime against humanity. Okay, because that child is not prepared to make such a decision. Okay, I think that such decisions about sex reassignment surgery must wait when attains a majority, which would be, it seems to me, a minimum of age 18. I'm very concerned with this because I think that it's become a fashion. Okay, that the transgender definition has become a kind of convenient label for young people who may simply feel alienated, okay, culturally for many other reasons. Okay, so that in the 1950s they might have become a beatnik, in the 1960s they might have become a hippie, and taken mind expanding drugs. Okay, and so today you're encouraged to think that it's an alienation is because you are not totally defined, identifying with your particular inherited gender definition. So I'm very concerned about this. I think that a lot of it, I think that the collaboration of the bureaucratic machinery with it has to do with the assault on masculinity. Okay. Ah. Okay. You see, gender doesn't really exist. It's not really polarity. I mean, everything's all about expanding women's rights, but also terminating men. Okay. And defining men out of existence.
Boom. Defining men out of existence. Exactly right. And when she talks about transgenderism now becoming a label for young people who might just feel alienated and would have become beatniks or hippies in previous generations, here are the statistics on that. In the UK, they have something, if they're in their NHS trust over there, called the Gender Identity Development Service. No kidding. And they said between April and September of this year, 1,302 children were referred to this gender identity development service, including 82 children under the age of 10, among them 2 4-year-olds. The overall number of referrals is more than a third up on the equivalent period last year. So you have 35% more kids included in this group of people who are being referenced for gender identity issues. All of a sudden, we're supposed to believe there's this explosion in mental illness, or is there more to it? Now, Camille Paglia went on, this is very interesting, explaining what she discovered by studying the past. Cut three.
historically, the movement toward androgyny occurs in late phases of culture. Okay, as a civilization is starting to unravel. Okay, and that you can find it again and again and again through history in the Greek art. Okay, you can see it happening. All of a sudden, okay, there's a kind of the sculptures of handsome nude young men athletes that used to be very robust. Okay, in the archaic period, suddenly began to seem like wet noodles. Okay, toward the end. Okay, and that the people who live in such periods, a late phase of culture. Whether it's the Hellenistic era, whether it's the Roman Empire, whether it's the Mauve decade of Oscar Wilde in the 1890s, whether it's Weimar Germany, people who live in such times, okay, feel that they're very sophisticated, they're very cosmopolitan, okay, and homosexuality, heterosexuality, so what, anything goes, and so on, all right, but from the perspective of historical distance, okay, you can see that it's a culture that no longer believes in itself.
Very interesting, isn't it? If you look throughout history, when you see the appearance of androgyny, it always appears as a culture is beginning to unravel. Doesn't this describe what's going on in the West, not just in the UK, but here in the United States? We're unraveling. And we're unraveling because we're returning to paganism. We're returning to Gnosticism. We're not progressing. We are regressing, and we are unraveling. This is why the Christian witness matters so much. We understand that God has created male and female as a reflection and image bearers of who he is and his character and his nature. And yes, we are fallen because we have sinned against him, and we inherit that sin nature from the first Adam. And we have the hope of eternal life and forgiveness of sin through the second Adam, Jesus Christ, as the book of Romans says. But we certainly cannot ignore the fact that even as people in our culture are thinking they're so sophisticated for embracing Bruce Jenner as a woman, it's insanity. It's complete insanity to do this. That's what's so striking about it, and how few people really want to come out and say the truth. It's like the kid seeing the parade. The emperor has no clothes. It looks good. It looks good. Oh, we love your robe, king. It looks great. Oh, fantastic knickers you've got there. Wonderful shoes. Oh, especially your hat. Isn't it fantastic? And in walks a little kid and says, "The emperor has no clothes. What are you talking about?" This is a lot like that, isn't it? It's a lot like that. We are unraveling, and it's because we have lost who God is. When you lose the Lord, and you lose the Lord in whose image we are created, you start losing yourself. You start losing touch with reality. You become Nebuchadnezzar on all fours eating grass. And it isn't until he lifts his eyes to the heavens that his sanity returns. Boy, do we need that in our day. This hour, Janet Mefford Today, was brought to you in part by Same Kind of Different as Me, based on an unforgettable true story of forgiveness, friendship, family, and faith. Same Kind of Different as Me, in theaters now. More information at samekindofdifferentasmemovie.com. Thanks a lot for joining us. We always enjoy having you here. God bless you. We'll see you next time.